Young, it's here and now. For the first time in 12 years, the Democratic Party is in control of both chambers of Congress. The 110th Congress convened today at noon East Coast time. Nancy Pelosi becomes the first woman Speaker of the House. Harry Reid of Nevada becomes Senate Majority Leader. The Democrats are promising to push through a slate of bills in the first 100 hours of the new session, tackling everything from ethics and lobbying reform to expanded funding for embryonic stem cell research. Well, David Nather is senior writer for Congressional Quarterly. He joins us from the Capitol. And David, we assume it's heady times for Democrats in Washington, but are they going to be accused of doing the same thing the Republicans did to them, not letting the minority have an input?
Well, sure, they're already being accused of that. You know, the first 100 hours agenda is their chance to push through a bunch of bills very, very quickly on priorities that they believe have broad appeal to the American people. But because they want to do it quickly in the House, they've said that they aren't going to allow the Republicans to offer amendments and alternatives and so forth. It's allowed the Republicans to come right back and accuse them of the same kind of heavy-handed leadership that, frankly, they used to complain about when the Republicans were in power.
Well, on the other hand, John McCain told the Today Show today, in effect, the Republicans might deserve this. He said, it's a sad day, but we lost our way. We got engaged in earmarking and pork barrel projects. We valued power over principle, and we paid a price. He seemed to be playing right into the Democrats' agenda for the next couple of days. Ethics and lobbying reform, including a ban on gifts and travel paid for by lobbying organizations. I understand there's a plan for rule changes that'll also take aim at the K Street Project. That's Tom DeLay's project to pressure trade groups to hire Republicans or face legislative consequences.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually the first substantive thing the House will do. The Democrats know that they have to come in and immediately show how they're different and make their mark by cutting private travel, for example, and banning gifts and meals from lobbyists and disclosing earmarks and doing all these other things to show how they're different. Of course, that is always easier said than done. There's a long history of ethical reforms in Congress that have died because some of the older veterans, for example, sort of like it the way it is now, and they don't think that Congress will get much credit even if it passes the strongest possible ethics package. So why bother? On Tuesday of next week, they want to try to implement most of the rest of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission that weren't done before. On Wednesday, they will try to increase the minimum wage. On Thursday, they'll try to expand stem cell research. And then on Friday, they're going to try to push through a bill to allow the government to negotiate lower Medicare prescription drug prices.
What is the likelihood of that all happening, all of that, in just a few days?
Well, the House is fairly easy to control if you're in the majority. And so they may be able to get most of these through the House, but that doesn't get it signed into law. You still have to get it through the Senate, where Democrats only have a very, very thin 51-seat majority, the thinnest possible. And frankly, in the Senate, you can filibuster, and to break filibuster, you need 60 votes. So that becomes even harder, even on unpopular measures. And then you got to get President Bush to sign it.
And by the way, you mentioned earmarks. These are the favored pieces of legislation that lawmakers get into broader legislation that is usually something that just helps their constituents or a particular lobbyist. President Bush weighed in on this yesterday. What did he say about earmarks, and how did the Democrats respond?
Well, he said the earmarks should be disclosed and cut back dramatically, just as Democrats have said. And so, of course, the response from Democrats was, well, that's great, but these earmarks have exploded under Republican majorities. So what kind of credibility does the president have to talk about that? The subtext here, though, is that there are actually a lot of fiscal conservatives within the Republican Party who are completely dismayed that the earmarks grew and expanded so much under Republican majorities.
And by the way, David, one last thing that the ethics rules change will not impact are campaign donations. And we understand that lobbyists are being invited like crazy to parties all this week as the Democrats celebrate their new majority. Nancy Pelosi having a big fundraiser tonight with Tony Bennett and members of the Grateful Dead. So there is one area in which the Democrats don't seem willing to wade.
Sure, exactly. Well, you know, nothing in this package cuts the costs of campaigns. They still have to raise money like crazy, and so they specifically steered all these reforms around fundraisers.
David Nather, senior writer for Congressional Quarterly. And by the way, this first 100 hours that the Democrats refer to, how are they counting that?
Well, it's 100 legislative hours. It's not literally like they're going to be in session for the next 4 or 5 days in a marathon. They start counting in next week, and it's only when the House is in session. And so you talk about 100 hours. It could actually last a couple of weeks and potentially more.
Months. It does. It sort of doesn't have the same urgency when you put it that way.
Yeah. Well, you know, 100 hours, 100 days, these kinds of things always sound good when you talk about them to the voters. They're much harder to do in practice, so they left themselves a lot of wiggle room.
David Nather, senior writer for Congressional Quarterly in Washington. David, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Well, on this day when the 110th Congress is being sworn in, we want to spend a few minutes on the country's birth certificate, the Declaration of Independence. We spoke a while back with Harvard professor David Armitage about the impact on the Declaration around the world. This month, his book on the subject, The Declaration of Independence, A Global History, will be published. So we're going to revisit that conversation. When we think about the document, we usually dwell on its Declaration of Individual Rights. The pursuit of happiness comes to mind. But first and foremost, it was a coming-out party for the whole United States, a grand entrance onto the international stage before the word international had even been coined. But then what? Well, according to David Armitage, Americans have never made a systematic attempt to trace the global afterlife of what came to be called American scripture. So that's what he does in his new book, and what an afterlife he finds. Today, he says, more than two centuries after the American Declaration of Independence was written, over half the countries in the world have their own versions. And he says it began quickly. The Declaration of Independence was soon passed hand to hand, country to country, like a flame.
Remarkably, rapidly passed around the world. I've traced it from its origins on the 4th of July. Within 8 weeks, it gets as far as Warsaw and Madrid through the circuits of exchange through the Atlantic world. Incredibly fast transmission for the 18th century.
Well, give us some context for this. I mean, how unique was it?
At the time that it was written, it was the first such document. The term Declaration of Independence had never been used before. In fact, it's not even used in the document itself, though contemporaries were calling it a Declaration of Independence within days of its being written. Thomas Jefferson and his fellow authors had no templates to work with when they were producing this, so it was a totally original document.
And as we were saying, it does, you know, declare individual rights, and most Americans tend to think of it that way, is that it's about individuals. But you really make clear that first and foremost, it was about the rights of states, the United States.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a Declaration of Independence as a birthday certificate for the United States itself, announcing their entry onto the international stage. The first paragraph doesn't begin, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." It begins, "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve its political bands and enter among the powers of the earth," that wonderful resonant phrase. The final paragraph, again, doesn't talk about individual rights. It talks about the rights of states, free and independent states, what they may of right do, which is to enter into alliances and treaties and make war and peace. That's the real structure of the document. Everything else is secondary to that.
And further, within in this time, it was just, it seems as if a time when those powers around the world were shifting from empire thinking to states thinking. Mm-hmm. Give us that context.
If you took a slice of the world in 1776 and looked around for the kinds of political bodies that most of us now live in, all of us now live in, states, you'd find relatively few of them. But across the world, you'd find great empires, the empires of the Dutch, the British, the Spanish, the French, still very much in operation in that period. The British, of course, have a huge empire spanning the globe. The rebellious colonists are trying to get out of that empire. They're trying to bring themselves onto the international stage as equals with Britain, as states, as free and independent states, 13 of them coming into a new international system on an equal footing. We think of our own moment as a great global moment, a moment of globalization, but it's not the first such moment. One of those earlier moments was around 1776. At that time, the world was being reshaped by commerce, linking together the oceans and the continents. But also across that and within that, there's a new system of states interacting with each other. The terms on which they interact with each other come to be called in this period international law, the law between sovereigns, the law between sovereign states in particular. And it's during the middle of that transformation that the colonists erupt onto the stage, and they're trying to put their statement about their entry into the world very much in these key up-to-date terms of the new norms of the international arena that they're entering into.
In fact, the very piece of paper, I don't know if you'd call it paper or parchment, that this was written on, kind of exemplifies this new globalization. How so?
The original printing of the Declaration of Independence, which took place on the night of the 4th of July, it was issued on the 5th of July, was done by an Irishman in Philadelphia. He printed it on paper, most of which, it's been shown, was Dutch, that had been imported from England. So we have an Irishman printing this great statement of Americanness on Dutch paper. Later in the summer, when the parchment manuscript of the Declaration is signed by the delegates to the Congress, they sign it with an inkstand, also made by an Irishman, but that inkstand was made out of silver. Where does silver come from in the 18th century? Mostly from Mexico and Peru. So these two versions of the document, the printed version and the manuscript version, both give evidence of the interconnections of the Atlantic world and the exchanges of ideas and people and goods in this period.
So as we're saying, it wasn't as much a declaration of independence, in many ways it was, but it was also a declaration of interdependence, you know, the idea that we all are working together. And you started the book with a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote 50 years afterwards, in which he seems to acknowledge that. Tell us about that letter.
Just before his death in 1826, Jefferson was invited to a 50th birthday party for the U.S. in Washington, D.C. He was very ill at that point. He would die just a couple of weeks later. And he sent that letter saying that he'd love to join the party, but he couldn't be there. But nevertheless issued a statement in which he called the Declaration an instrument pregnant with our own fate and the fate of the world, and saw it as a great inspiration to others around the world who were seceding from empires.
Do you think he knew? Do you think they knew when they were crafting the document how much it would be imitated, taken from, used?
I'm sure they had no idea. Certainly the point at which they're putting it forward in July 1776 is a tense moment in the process of the American Revolution. There was no hope of success at that point. They were producing the document not least in order to get allies, military allies and financial allies, to aid the embattled American cause. It could easily have failed, and this might be lying in an archive, a British archive somewhere. Scholars might be looking for this document as the emblem of a failed secessionist revolt. There are many failed declarations of independence around the world. It might have joined those. It might not have had that inspirational force to it. It's the very success of the American cause, as much as the philosophy or the language of the document, which ensures it has a global afterlife.
David Armitage, professor of history at Harvard University. We're talking about his book, The Declaration of Independence, A Global History. When we come back, how the words written by Thomas Jefferson echo in more modern-day documents that declare the independence of other countries. Ho Chi Minh, for instance, modeled Vietnam's on America's. By the way, we're also following news out of Washington. Our top story, the 110th Congress convenes today. Also today, White House counsel Harriet Myers has offered her resignation. President Bush nominated his longtime friend and counsel in October of 2005 to replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, but Myers dropped out under fire from conservatives who questioned her qualifications. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow said the president reluctantly accepted her resignation today. She will leave at the end of the month. No reason was given. Myers has been with the Bush White House for all 6 years. Well, still coming up today, doctors and nurses suffering from compassion fatigue, what they're doing about that. And also, when we come back right after the break, more on the Declaration of Independence. Stay with us here and now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now, and we're back with more of our talk with Harvard history professor David Armitage, who's studied the history of the Declaration of Independence and the birth of America. And by the way, Professor Armitage says there's a comparison between what's going on today in Iraq and what was going on in the colonies in 1776. He says the founding fathers here were also looking for a way to hold insurgent groups in the north, the south, and central parts of this new country together, so they wouldn't be gobbled up by the French or the Spanish. His book, The Declaration of Independence, A Global History, is being published this month. We spoke with him last year. And another fascinating point he makes is how so many other countries modeled their own declarations of independence on the words of Thomas Jefferson.
If you look around world history since 1776, you can find more than 100. I've got about 120, 130 examples of declarations of independence, many successful, some failed. And of the 192 states that are now represented at the United Nations, more than half of them have a document that they themselves recognize as a declaration of independence. Quite a lot of those documents took language and structure from the American Declaration itself. Quite a lot of them develop variations around the idea of a Declaration of Independence, not necessarily looking specifically back to the American Declaration itself. In the book, I call this the beginning of a genre, the beginning of a template, an idea which other people can take up, whether consciously or unconsciously, from the American example to announce their entering onto the world stage, to give their birth certificate.
I'm looking at the Venezuelan Declaration of Independence, 1811. It's got an opening paragraph that names the states of Venezuela, and then it says, "We deem it unnecessary to insist upon the unquestionable right which every conquered country possesses to restore itself to liberty and independence." That seems to resonate with the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one. I was reading Vietnam's. It's also beautifully written, but it's a litany of harms.
Mm-hmm.
And that directly goes to the American Declaration of Independence as well. Americans forget that there is a section in ours, too, that sort of says how we felt we were harmed.
It's the list of the charges against King George III in the middle of the document, the specific charges against him, and many subsequent declarations of independence take up that very same structure. They take a set of damages, harms, grievances against often colonial masters, and the Vietnamese example is a very good one. Ho Chi Minh, who wrote that document, was a great admirer of George Washington, and when he was writing the document, he got a translation to make sure that he was quoting it correctly, and in fact, the very opening lines of that Vietnamese declaration come straight from the American one.
Here's the opening line. "All men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." This is in the Vietnam Declaration of Independence, and then further down, they list the grievances. For more than 80 years, the French imperialists, abusing their liberty, equality, and fraternity, have violated the land of our ancestors. That's literally acknowledging the Declaration of Independence of the U.S. Where else do you see it, acknowledged, maybe not as straight out?
You can see it in places where American influence had an important impact, for instance, in Liberia in the 1840s.
When, which was founded by American freed slaves.
Exactly, and their Declaration of Independence follows the structure of the American Declaration and a lot of its language as well. My favorite example is one that casts some interesting light back on the American document, and that's the Unilateral Declaration of Independence of Southern Rhodesia in 1965, a case where a minority white government in southern Rhodesia proclaimed its independence in order that it would not have to follow the directives of the British government in order not least to democratize its political system. They declared independence not of the crown, unlike the Americans, but of the British government and its control. And they took, the structure and the language of the American Declaration to make their own entry into the world on the same kinds of terms as the Americans, using American language, but for very different reasons, and certainly omitting entirely any reference to equality. Quality,
right.
Liberty, or the pursuit of happiness there.
But it begins, "Whereas in the course of human affairs, history has shown that it may become necessary for a people to resolve the political affiliation which have connected them with another people."
Mm-hmm.
So, sort of can't argue with that, except, as you said, a very different situation. And you do say that's one of the problems of the Declaration of Independence, that it was the independence of the states. But then problems can arise when perhaps within those independent states, indigenous peoples also want their independence.
There are really two messages in the Declaration of Independence. One is about the right of states to exist alongside other states. The second set of messages is the one that's obviously much more important to individual Americans, which is the description of the rights of individuals, the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those two things obviously can come into tension with each other when certain groups find that the rights of states are trampling on their own individual rights, and it's certainly been one of the key features of the modern world that states that have declared their independence ever after refuse independence to any other internal groups. There are very, very few examples of independent states allowing any part of their territory or any group within their territory to break away and set up an independent state.
Which, of course, brings us to the phrase, "all men are created equal." Now, we know that the idea of liberating the slaves was percolating at the time the U.S. was being born. During the Revolution, thousands of black slaves fought on the side of the British because the British promised them individual freedom, and they wouldn't have that if the colonies won. But you say the crafters of the Declaration were remarkably forward-thinking in putting the phrase about equality in anyway, not for immediate use because they knew it would be too soon, but for future use.
Absolutely. And certainly the very fact that the document incorporated those individual rights allowed particularly British critics of it, to accuse the American colonists of utter hypocrisy. There's one commentator in 1776 who said there's no sight more appalling than a slave-driving American colonist whipping his slaves while also writing declarations of independency, putting into a document these rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness while also denying it to hundreds of thousands of human beings in the colonies themselves. That remains one of the great paradoxes of the American Revolution, and it's there behind the document itself.
Do you have a favorite phrase?
I think it might be from the very opening paragraph where the authors of the Declaration address themselves to the opinions of mankind. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they, the colonists, should declare the causes which impel them to their separation. I think that sense of a decent respect for the rest of the world, a necessity of entering into equal terms, into a dialogue with the rest of the world, is perhaps a message that we can still take from the Declaration of Independence today.
Yeah. And also, as you write, that they were conveying to the British, we were enemies, but we will be friends.
Or, if you treat us like enemies, we will treat you like enemies. In war, enemies; in peace, friends. They're very clear in the document about the new terms on which they're going to treat their former masters, but they're now equals in the international sphere.
David Armitage, professor of history at Harvard. His book, The Declaration of Independence, A Global History, is being published this month. It's a terrific read. Well, still ahead, how doctors and nurses are fighting compassion fatigue. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Hero. It's Here and Now. The 110th Congress is formally convening in Washington, D.C. this afternoon in inauguration ceremonies kicked off by Clerk of the House Karen Haas.
Members-elect, this is the day fixed by the 20th Amendment to the Constitution and Public Law 109447 for the meeting of the 110th Congress.
After 12 years, the minority Democrats are taking control of Congress. San Francisco Democrat Nancy Pelosi becomes the first female Speaker of the House. This morning, she began her day at a Catholic prayer service where she was greeted by anti-abortion protesters. As we mentioned earlier in the program, first on the agenda for the House, ethics reform. Lawmakers are expected to vote as early as this evening on tighter restrictions on their privately financed trips, as well as more disclosures of which lawmakers are earmarking money for pet projects. Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy says the election that put Democrats back in power was about change. Kennedy, one of the leading critics of the war in Iraq, also told us today he's opposed to the surge of troops in Iraq that President Bush is expected to announce next week.
As a member of the Armed Services Committee, I listened carefully to General Abizaid, who appeared before our committee just probably 5 or 6 weeks ago, and he has been the commanding general. He said we do not need additional kind of troops. We don't need to expand our footprint, military footprint over there. Our military have done everything they've been asked to do. What we need are political resolutions, political judgments, political decisions.
Democrats will hold as many as a dozen oversight hearings on the Iraq War in the coming weeks. And finishing off our political roundup today, Democratic governors will take the helm in a majority of state capitals this month. Today, two Republican governors will be inaugurated in Nebraska and Vermont. And two Democrats take the corner office in New Hampshire and here in Massachusetts, where the first Democrat in 16 years was sworn in, former Clinton administration official Deval Patrick, who also makes history as the state's first African-American governor, the country's second in modern times.
I, Deval L. Patrick,
Deval L. Patrick,
do solemnly swear that I will bear true faith and allegiance,
that I will bear true faith and allegiance,
and will support the Constitution,
and will support the Constitution
of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Exiting the governor's office in Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, a Republican who filed papers yesterday to explore a presidential run in 2008. When we think about health and medicine, we tend to think about procedures and drugs and insurance. But of course, it's also about people. And sometimes life in the trenches can take a toll on the medical staff who deliver that care. Here now's Alan Cockle has this story of how some healthcare workers are coping.
As an idealistic young doctor, Beth Lown opened the kind of clinic that almost doesn't exist anymore.
I went into solo private practice as a young woman. I must have been nuts.
This was 1985 at Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge. She was fresh out of her residency in internal medicine.
I was excited because I could fashion it however I wanted, and I did everything. I washed all the Johnnies. I took them home and did them in my laundry. I don't think my family was too happy about that. I did all my EKGs. I gave all the injections. I did everything. It was a one-woman show, so to speak. And I really knew those folks. I knew all my patients really, really well.
Dr. Lowne wanted to do more than dole out pills and order tests. She believed, and still believes, in a holistic kind of doctoring, in the power of intimate, personal connections.
When you make a commitment to really provide care, it's a very profound commitment. It occupies a deep part of your soul.
But over time, the administrative parts of medicine, the checklists and bureaucracy, increasingly shouldered their way into her practice. She gave up that practice to become a hospital employee. But still, she describes feeling like she had a village in her head.
I'd be always thinking through a clinical problem or concern. This is common, I think, checking up on a lab, making sure that you had absolutely missed nothing, that nothing had fallen through the cracks. I'd worry a lot about emotional issues in people's lives and whether or not I had somehow been able to be what they needed. So just all of these things are so constantly going through your mind. There's very rarely free space. So I'd go home and I'd find myself exhausted, not fully available to my own family.
Beth Lowne's situation is common enough that it has a name in the medical literature. Burnout. Anecdotal evidence suggests that burnout is increasing, and a national study this year found that 1 in 5 doctors at academic medical centers were depressed. There were also high rates of anxiety and job dissatisfaction. Beth Lowne, after 15 years, decided to leave primary care. She now teaches medical residents, helping them to connect with patients.
Doctoring's really an act of love in a big way, and we try to help people feel that inside themselves, which I believe many physicians do have that. I think it gets squelched to some extent by the crush of everyday tasks, but I believe it's there.
Around the time that Dr. Lowne made her career change, a center dedicated to fostering the humanity in medicine was just getting going. The Kenneth B. Schwartz Center started at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Its signature program, Schwartz Rounds, has since spread to nearly 100 medical centers.
The two patients whom we are going to address today are both young men.
Dr. Gary Whitman is leading the Schwartz Rounds on this day at Good Samaritan Hospital in Brockton.
They are considered social misfits. They are disheveled, and they smell. They both intentionally provoke rage by their use of vulgar language and contempt for the needs of others. They take us as healthcare providers to our wits' end and create compassionate fatigue.
The monthly rounds offer doctors, nurses, and other hospital staff a chance to talk through the social and emotional issues they encounter in caring for patients. After introducing the topic of compassion fatigue, Dr. Whitman turns the discussion over to the packed conference room.
And if someone's acting up, you remove yourself from the situation.
Nurse Victoria Holsinger is one of the first to speak.
There were days that I'd come home and have a really bad day, and I would go into the bathroom and turn the water on so that I could decompress. And since then, I've learned how to meditate, and I do it twice a day, once in the morning and once at bedtime. But that works really well. And
what works for Dr. Gautam Parikh, balance comes from contemplating the woods outside his office window, one of his more successful attempts to let go of workaday stress.
At the end of the day, I just look at that before I do my charts for about 5 or 10 minutes, and it really helps to rejuvenate. I try to get little Japanese contraption where these pendulum swings on the sand and, you know, make some patterns and everything. And very next day, this patient came and put hand on the sand, you know, and completely ruined it. But still, it works for me, and I think you just have to deal with it each occasion as it happens.
I think these rounds are a wonderful opportunity for people to talk about their personal lives.
It's rare in any workplace for people to gather to talk openly like this. Steve Bresnahan, a physician coordinator for the Schwartz Rounds, says the rounds ultimately improve patient care.
Believe me, we all have these feelings. None of us are perfect people, so we all have days where we've been played upon and we find ourselves being mechanical and robotic, and as the sports coaches would say, your head's not in the game.
Trying to stay in the game and stay balanced, Dr. Bresnahan says, is what it's all about.
It's Here Now's Alan Cockle. For a link to information about the Schwartz Center, go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Football fans, arrange the furniture. The NFL has its wild card weekend coming up. 4 games in 2 days, including our beloved New England Patriots. They play the New York Jets on Sunday. And for college football fans, after dozens of bowl games, the Bowl Championship Series Championship will be played Monday night in Glendale, Arizona, where unbeaten Ohio State meets Florida. Here with a preview and the rest of the news from the world of sports, Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. Bill, always nice to see you.
Thank you, Robin.
If it's Bill, it's Thursday. And on Saturday, the Kansas City Chiefs take on the Indianapolis Colts, while the Dallas Cowboys play the Seattle Seahawks. There seems to be a lot of talk as to whether or not this is Coach Bill Parcells' last year with the Dallas Cowboys. Bill, as you all know, he spent time here in Boston and New York, but had some conflicts with the Cowboys. Is that going to overshadow the game?
Well, you're coming into the realm of my New Year's resolution, Robin, which is to pay no attention to idle speculation about the personalities of people paid millions of dollars to be involved with games. I will still pay attention to games, but I'm trying to stay away from the speculation about the personalities.
Oh, right. What are we going to do for the next 4 minutes?
I'll probably break my resolution with the next question.
Well, on Sunday, the New York Giants play the Philadelphia Eagles in Philadelphia. As we said here in Boston, the Patriots are going to take on the Jets at Foxborough. The Patriots have had some big injuries in the past few weeks, including safety Rodney Harrison. Do you think they can overcome those?
Well, Rodney Harrison is a terrific presence in the clubhouse, besides being a wonderful player. I think they probably can overcome his absence as far as playing the Jets is concerned. If his absence is prolonged, they may have some real issues down the road a little.
Right. Well, let's take a look at college football Monday night, the bowl season finally. What were there, 9,000 games?
Yeah, I was going to say, if people haven't rearranged the furniture by now, it's probably too late. They should have done it a month ago.
Well, Monday, the Ohio State Buckeyes meet the Florida Gators. Ohio State has been the team to beat, I'm told, pretty much for the last month or so. So what do you think? Do the Gators have a chance?
Well, Robin, that's why they play the games, you know?
Wait, no, we want you to speculate.
You don't win these games on paper unless the games you're playing are crossword puzzles. That's my byword for this time around. Ohio State, obviously vastly favored. But the problem is Ohio State, because of the way the bowl system is set up and the championship game is placed on the calendar, Ohio State hasn't played football for 51 days, and they may have forgotten everything.
That's a long time.
It's a very long time. It's almost 2 months.
All right, so let's see. That might be more interesting. Last night, 11th-ranked Notre Dame beaten by 4th-ranked Louisiana State, beaten bad. But the bowl game that everyone's talking about, number 9 Boise State beats number 7 Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. But to many of us, the big part was the end, the marriage proposal.
The ultimate trick play.
Well, tell us what happened.
Well, one of the players proposed to his girlfriend, who was the cheerleader, at the end of a play. And all I could think was, you know, and this is one of these things where the proposal goes up on the scoreboard that stuff. What happens if her answer is, I don't know, I'll have to think about it. I mean, does all the air go out of the stadium, right?
He was down on his knees, and there he was patting him on his shoulders.
Absolutely.
But she seemed to say yes.
She did. That's my understanding.
Moving on to basketball in the NBA, Miami Heat coach Pat Riley surprised a lot of people. He announced yesterday he's going to take a leave from coaching that team in order to have knee surgery. And also on that team, player Antoine Walker, former Celtic. What's the story with him?
Well, Antoine Walker and James Posey were both declared ineligible because their body fat index was too high, according to on January 1st. Give me a break, January 1st. But, you know, the team had said you got to lose a certain amount of weight. They hadn't lost it. Plus, they've had injuries to Dwayne Wade, Shaq, of course, Jason Williams. And now the coach. So this is a team that's laboring under considerable duress.
Right. And reminding many of us, we will never be NBA basketball players.
It's just one of the many reasons that won't happen, yes.
Quick last thought. Let's see. On Monday, Texas Tech coach Bob Knight, some love him, some hate him. He got his 888th win. He passes North Carolina coach Dean Smith. Most wins in Division I men's college basketball. Your thoughts on the achievement?
He's a blowhard. He's a bully. He's a loudmouth, and he still hasn't got nearly as many wins as Pat Summitt, who is the coach of the women's team at Tennessee. Call me when he reaches her.
As we said, Only a Game host Bill Littlefield tells it like it is, not swayed by titles like that. Bill covers all the world of sports every weekend. Don't miss it. And as always, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Anything more you want to say about Bill Knight?
Oh,
we've run out of time. More ahead here and now. Thank you. Robin Young, It's Here and Now. The Gramophone Awards are considered the Oscars of the classical music world, and when they were announced in late September, a surprising name was on the list of winners, choreographer Mark Morris. Morris is the first non-musician ever to win a gramophone, and last spring, Here and Now's Lynn Medegon had a chance to observe his musicality in action as he choreographed a dance called Up and Down for Boston Ballet. Unconventionally, Morris was rehearsing not dancers, but musicians, as they practiced his surprising musical choice, a saxophone quartet by Alexander Glazunov.
Wow. I'm turning red sympathetically. That's a lot of air blowing out of all those scales, right? Like it's like a slow leak. Like you don't get to produce sound with all of it. Some of it just escapes forever. As I said to the dancers, it's like farting in the bathtub. Sorry, don't take that personally, but the sort of lightness of it. I'm more interested in the big beats of four to be in time. I don't mind if the scales are, the scales can float more. It gets a little bit martial.
This was a little too didactic then, a little too martial.
I would never have said didactic, but yes. It can be a little less strict. It can swing a little bit more. How about that?
Now you're in my vernacular. Okay. That's good. I don't know if I'm insulted or not.
My name's Tom Ferranti.
And your instrument is formally called the?
It's a soprano saxophone. It's a top voice of the saxophone quartet.
Have you ever done anything like this before, worked with dancers?
Nothing quite like this, no, with him. And he sure knows music. I've had a lot of experience in music, 50 years of it, and this is one of the highlights.
Boston Ballet conductor Jonathan McPhee has known Mark Morris since the early 1980s, when, back then, Morris was known as the bad boy of the New York dance scene.
You know, I'd sort of heard of him, Mark Morris Dance Company in New York, but was totally unprepared for the guy that showed up in the studios in cutoffs, a torn t-shirt, cigarette in one hand, drink in the other hand, and just, he looked like a wild man, and started working with the dancers. And, you know, one thing that's held true over the many years of watching him work, the exterior that you see, you don't have to be with him too long before you realize that actually he cares intensely. He works very hard. He has a lot to say.
I don't want to really a rallentando to the last, like, bar and a half.
Now, the appeal, I think, is something that's very interesting to have watched over the years, because traditionally, a modern choreographer appeals to a very small audience. There have been two exceptions that I can think of in the last 50, 60 years. Martha Graham and Mark Morris. And there's a good reason that they have appealed to a larger audience. When you go to a Mark Morris dance event these days, you will see the diehard Mark Morris dance fans. You'll see classical ballet people. What's more important is you'll see music people who show up. Now, music people are notoriously difficult to get into the dance realm. So why the appeal? Why is he larger than what you would expect? It's the musicality.
I was thinking of other things, but
you did. That's great.
The articulation, yeah. You want the articulation more clear there.
Exactly. It also, some of these pages in the finale also start to sound like just the long way to get into the right key. Mm-hmm. You know, it gets a little bit fillery sounding if it's so. It just gets a little bit washy. So if we have these little sub beats, it's more interesting. And they'll dance better. They'll be able to hear it better. But that's great.
A brilliant choreographer makes you listen to the music in a way that you would not normally have listened to it. And I think about Martha, first of all, because she's the one that started me in the dance field. I used to be amazed at watching how she would choreograph with the dancers a line that was almost missing from the score. In other words, if you had an orchestra score and it had all the different instruments in it, it's almost as if she wrote another instrument line in the score that had visual rhythm, to the point where sometimes when she choreographed something, she was so in tune with the music that she could actually do a movement that would make you think you heard a note that wasn't there. And Mark does the same kind of thing. He actually works from the inside of the music out so that you actually will react more intensely to the score.
Good. You know, I want it to be like the national anthem of some place we don't know the name of. But what I like is that it goes da-da-da-da-da, and it's like a trick loop that it started over.
Sometimes he's been criticized for having too slavish a response to the music. Do you think that that's true?
No, I don't really agree with that. There are times when he does things to the music that I really don't like, and that's okay. I mean, there are lots of pieces of music I don't like, and I'm a musician. That's fine. So I think the criticism, well, everybody's open to criticism, but the important thing is that here is somebody who consistently makes you notice the music.
Less of a retard. This is really like the folk tune from somewhere we've never been. You
know, so and that's really, a genius?
Yeah, that's a word I really, rarely use. Martha was a genius. Leonard Bernstein was a genius. I think Mark Morris is right up there. He's one of the few choreographers I know who can actually build steps that have enough flexibility to be able to give musical latitude to a performance. You know, so many times you run into choreographers today who only work with a CD, which is one fixed result. The ones who have had little experience with live music will say, I want it just like my CD, you know, which just, you know, is like a knife in the heart of every musician.
Here now is Lynn Manigan speaking with Boston musicians about the musicality of choreographer Mark Morris, who's won a Gramophone Award for his contributions to the world of classical music. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.